at the end of chapter 4. Now, first of all, what's the first six chapters of the book of Ezra about?
About
what?
Things about Ezra, before Ezra's return.
Before Ezra's return. And this return from where?
Babylon.
Captivity, right? And who headed this return that we read about in the first six chapters? Zerubbabel and Joshua the high priest, right? Okay? And what position did Zerubbabel hold when he got back to their homeland? Governor. Good. Okay, so they lead the return, and what did they set about to do when they got back? Rebuild the temple. So they got the foundation laid. Did they finish right away?
No.
Why? Got discouraged. Why? Opposition. That's right. And that's what we were studying about. Now, when you get to chapter 4, and verse 24, it says, then the work on the house of God in Jerusalem ceased. You know, when you think about the odds they were facing, maybe we can appreciate a little more, although it doesn't justify them. Wonder how we would conduct ourselves in the face of that. How many approximately people returned to their homeland from the captivity? About 50, about 42,000 something, but under 50,000. How many people live in the humble Kingwood area? A lot more than that. What if the humble Kingwood area, even though it's a larger number, were pitted against the whole state of Texas or the whole United States? What do you think our odds would be? Yet these people came back to a land where they were the minority. They were a much smaller number than the people of the land. Another thing you consider, let's suppose you just moved to this country with your family and you tried to engage in the religion that you believed was the religion of your God. Well, let's say you moved to another country. Let's say you moved to a Muslim country. You tried to engage in that religion, even if a good number of you moved. And yet, everybody there not only practiced a different religion, but their fathers had practiced a different religion, and their grandfathers had practiced a different religion. They were entrenched in the land. They had their homes and their property and all of that. And if they opposed you, would you get discouraged? That's these people. They're moving back. It was their homeland at one time, but they had been away now for 70 years. And these other people were entrenched in the land with their traditions and their religions. Not only that, if you moved to this other land and you tried to practice the religion you believed was the true religion, and they brought the political forces to bear against you to stop you, how would that affect you? That's exactly what was happening here. And then on top of that, they were misrepresented. In chapter 4, verse 13, it says they will not pay tribute, custom, or toll. Suppose in bringing this opposition against you, they mischarge you. They say, you know, these people are going to try to topple your government. They won't pay taxes. And that's not your intent at all. Those are some of the things that they faced as they set out to rebuild the temple. Were these good reasons? What would be your answer? They said, well, yeah, but look, here are the circumstances. Would you say, oh, I see, I understand, I agree with you. I see why you quit. Yes. Okay, and Roz made a good point that we're going to look at here in a moment. They didn't stop on their own houses and all. Of course, they might say, yeah, but nobody opposed us on that. How do you know from chapter 5 it was not a good, these reasons were not good? What? God got frustrated with them. And what did he do? Sent two prophets. And these prophets, particularly Haggai, didn't speak too kindly of their attitude, did he? And Haggai, as we'll look at in just a moment, mentioned the very thing Rod talked about, to try to bring them to a consideration of their attitude. And so we can make excuses and feel comfortable in it, but it doesn't mean God's pleased with it. God's not going to raise up a prophet today, so if we want to know what God thinks, what are we going to have to do? Study. We have to go to the prophet's writings. Thus the need to continually be reading, continually letting the Word of God be on our hearts, so that that message continues to try to penetrate, try to awaken us up. And thus the value of Bible study. And in our prayer with Robert a while ago, we talked about that very thing, because we might benefit from times like these. And hopefully, although you know the book of Ezra and you've studied the book of Ezra, by reminding ourselves of these things, maybe it'll be of some benefit to us. And there's certainly some valuable lessons here as we look at what Haggai told the people in just a moment. So, as we get into chapter 5, you had written a synopsis of each chapter. And by the way, on chapter 6, you've already discovered, if you've done it, that there's a typographical error. Review your synopsis of chapter, not 4, but 6, and the first question on chapter 6. I imagine you figured that out. But anyway, on chapter 5, in the early part in our introduction, we went through the book and tried to write a synopsis of each chapter. And when you did chapter 5, what did you put down as a synopsis of chapter 5? What's this chapter about? Very good. The work resumes with Haggai and Zechariah's support. And that could kind of summarize this chapter. It's helpful to me, maybe you find it helpful, go back and look when you study the book of Haggai to have these simple, brief chapter synopsis. And that way you kind of get a grasp of what the flow of the book and where you're at when you turn, for example, to chapter 5. Okay. So, that's pretty obvious, number 2, then. We just answered that one, didn't we? Who motivated the people. So let's start in verse 1. When the prophets, Haggai, the prophet, and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel who was over them, then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Josadak, arose and began to rebuild the house of God, which is in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, supporting them. It says in verse 1 that these two men, Haggai and Zechariah, prophesied to the Jews. That's what the text says, isn't it? Go over to Haggai 1, and you might want to hold your finger over there because we'll be going back and forth for a few minutes. Look at Haggai chapter 1, if you will. When you read Haggai's record, what does that record say as to who Haggai prophesied to? Verse 1. Zerubbabel and Joshua. Well, over here it says to the Jews. Over here it says to Zerubbabel and Joshua. And if you're familiar with Old Testament history, you may remember way back in the time of Moses that when God wanted to speak to the people, he'd do that through their leaders, to Moses. And then Moses would get, or Aaron would get the elders together. The elders were the representatives of the people. You'll see that way back in Exodus chapter 4. And talk to the elders, and the elders would address the people. And so Moses and Aaron, that's how they might address the people, or how God might address the people. And so when you read over here, they prophesied to the Jews. You see over here that there were two leaders particularly. And it was their responsibility to help the people do what God intended them to do. And so you see when you look at Haggai chapter 5 and verse 2, it doesn't say then the Jews began to build. It says Zerubbabel and Jeshua began to build. Well, it's not that Zerubbabel and Jeshua necessarily did all the manual labor. That's not the point. They began to do their work as leaders to encourage the people to do what they ought to do. These are valuable lessons for us as leaders. And whether that be the leader of your family, whether that be an elder in the church or whatever that may be, that as leaders, we have the responsibility to encourage people to duty. When we look at the book of Malachi, which we're not going to do right now, much of that prophecy, the bulk of it, was to their leaders, the priests. And their failure to expect from the people what God intended. And so leaders, I guess, can get complacent. Maybe they can get discouraged. Maybe Zerubbabel and Jeshua just kind of fell in with the bad habits of the people and got comfortable with it. I don't know, but that can happen to those who lead, that they just adopt the lackadaisical attitude or the excuses that people may offer. This is a good lesson for us all not to let that happen. So Zechariah and Haggai stir up these two leaders to do their work. And we ask you to read Haggai, the first two chapters, and Zechariah chapter 1. And note the dates in these chapters. And if you did, in Haggai chapter 1, it says the second year of Darius on the first day of the sixth month. Now over here in chapter 4 of Ezra and verse 24, you see the work stopped until the second year of Darius. So you could see Haggai, that's when Haggai picks up his work. And it's in the first day of the sixth month. When you look at Haggai chapter 2 and verse 10, you'll see that his work went through the ninth month. So the sixth month to the ninth month, very short book. These oracles that you find in the book of Haggai. When you look at Zechariah chapter 1 and verse 1, you'll see that Zechariah picked up during the work of Haggai. Haggai started the sixth month. In verse 1 of Zechariah 1, he picked up in the eighth month. So he followed Zechariah by a couple months, but he too was involved in this work of stirring up these leaders. And Rod has already alluded to the answer to this next question. So look at Haggai chapter 1. So Haggai the prophet, and remember, he's speaking from the standpoint of God. What is a prophet? A mouthpiece for God. That's right. And so when God wanted to speak to the people, he didn't whisper in their ear. He sent a prophet. The same is true today. We don't have living prophets. We have written prophets. The scriptures. But this is the way God chose to speak. And so as you read the book of Haggai, you're actually reading what God said about them and their attitudes. And so, we sometimes may wonder, what does God think of us? Well, the prophets will tell us. And that's what we have here. In Haggai chapter 1 and verse 2, 4, and 9, what did Haggai point to that exposed their excuses for not completing the temple? What did he point to in verse 2 and 4? What did they say?
Time's not right.
Time's not right. How long had it been? 20 years? Time's not right. It's not time yet. What? Well, what exposed the weakness of that in verse 4 and verse 9? Rod's already told us. They found time to build their houses. You dwell, now note, not just in your houses, in your panel houses. Here's the house of the Lord. It's in ruins. I don't know how much they got done before they quit after they laid the foundation. But there's a state of ruins. Nebuchadnezzar came in and destroyed that whole area. You can imagine all the rubble around. Well, they don't bother them. But when they get home, they like that home to be comfortable. And they have panel houses. In verse 9, he said, because my house which lies desolate while each of you... Now, what is the idea of runs to his own house? What do you think that's talking about? Is that talk about that run opposite walking, or what's that connote? Okay. They love their houses. They showed zeal about their houses, didn't they? And, so they found the time, they found the effort. It was important to them to get their houses comfortable. But it wasn't so important to get God's house built. Sir? Home sweet home. Is this a lesson for us? We don't have a physical temple to build. But do we have work in the kingdom of God to do that we neglect? But we get that house work done. We get that yard work done. We get those cars taken care of. We take those vacations. But that work in the kingdom of God, well, it's not time right now. We'll get to it. I don't know, but I know it makes me stop and look at myself. And this was, and the leaders had the responsibility, evidently, of addressing these people and encouraging them to get out of this. The leaders, if they're going to encourage the people who are in this state of lethargy, might they come under the people's disfavor? Sure, but they didn't excuse them for their responsibility in this. And Haggai, regardless of how the people took it, that's what he preached. And that's what we find, of course, Paul telling Timothy, in season or out of season, preach the word. And that's the responsibility of any person who's going to teach the word of God. You'll notice also in Haggai chapter 1, something else. In verse 14, if you read this, you may have noticed it says, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel. How did he stir up the spirit of Zerubbabel? That's right, sending them Haggai and Zechariah. That's exactly right. So that's how it was done. And so God can stir people's hearts if they'll listen to his prophets. And that's what we see in this particular text. You'll note in the text in Haggai 1, Haggai the messenger of the Lord spoke by the commission of the Lord to the people, saying, I am with you, declares the Lord. So the Lord stirred up. In other words, as a result of Zechariah's prophecy, which included warnings and rebuke, but also comfort, so the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel. Okay? Any other comments about Haggai and Zechariah here before we move on? Okay. And so it says the prophets of God were with them, supporting them by their prophecies, by telling them God's will. You read Zechariah, there was not only, and Haggai as well, not only reproof, but also encouragement. You see that through. In fact, go back to Haggai for just a moment. I do want to note something before I leave it. In verse 2, 4, and 9, we just read those. You see Haggai employing reproof. Reproof is to show people in what way their lives are wrong. In verse 8, he employs command, that is God's command. Go up to the mountain, bring wood, and rebuild the temple, that I may be pleased with it and be glorified. In verse 10 and 11, and in verse chapter 2, verse 14, you see warning. In other words, your crops hadn't bore, you're having difficulty. Let me tell you why. You're suffering under the judgment of God. They were a theocratic nation, and that's how God dealt with that nation. And so he used warning, and then he also used exhortation. He encouraged them with words of promise in chapter 2 that God would bless this work. And so all of these are employed by the prophet Haggai in stirring up the people. When you prepare a lesson to teach a class or to teach or preach, you men, these are some of the things you see that the prophets employed in stirring up people.
Yes? We don't have a problem today ourselves, but back then they probably said, somebody needs to do that.
We don't have that problem?
No.
Where have you been living? I don't know, it's easy for me to do that. I don't know, and I hear brethren, you know, let somebody do it, somebody else do it. I think it's got a good point. And it's easy to let somebody else do it, but it was their responsibility. Yeah, the somebody starts with looking in the mirror, doesn't it? That's right. Okay. So in chapter 5, verse 3, at that time, Tatanai, the governor of the province beyond the river. Now, Nehemiah was governor, but evidently he was a sub-governor to this guy. This guy was evidently over the province beyond the river, and Nehemiah just over that province of Judah, and so actually under this particular governor of the Persian government. And so Tatanai, the governor of the province beyond the river, and Shethar Bozanai, I don't know if that's how I pronounce it. If I read it a second time, I'll pronounce it differently probably. But anyway, and their colleagues came to them and spoke to them thus, who issued you a decree to rebuild this temple and to finish this structure? Then we told them accordingly what the names of the men were who were reconstructing this building. But the eye of their God was on the elders. Hold your finger here and go to Psalm 34, 15. Does this verse sound familiar to you? Psalm 34, 15. If so, do you remember where in the New Testament it's referred to? You've studied it recently. I mean, real recently. I mean, in the past 3 months. The verse says, the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, his ears are open to their cry. Look at 1 Peter. First Peter chapter 3. He's writing to people living in an ungodly world. They're facing opposition. But he says, verse 9, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult. So they were on the receiving end of mistreatment and insults. But then he says, verse 12, for the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous and his ears attend to their prayer, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. And so that comforting message that God is with you and he's listening to your prayers and he knows your circumstances, was used to encourage even the people over 500 years later in the New Testament period. And so when you pray, you wrestle with the things you face in life, if you're faithful and fear God, remember the eye of the Lord is with those who serve Him in the face of difficult circumstances. In this particular case, God's blessing them was to see that their work would continue without opposition of the government forces. The eye of God was on the elders of the Jews, and they did not stop them. So they couldn't stop these two men. What happened to the first time they faced opposition? Did they stop? They did stop. This time they didn't stop. And so these two leaders would not stop. And they did not stop them until a report could come to Darius, and then a written reply be returned concerning it. So these men did not stop them. And that's different from, you'll see if you read the letter in chapter 4, and you read this one that they sent to Darius, there's a totally different tone, these two letters. In chapter 4, you notice a number of very antagonistic remarks that are made in their letter. Notice in verse 12 of chapter 4, he said, they are rebuilding the rebellious and evil city. Verse 13, they will not pay tribute, custom, or toll. Verse 14, it is not fitting for us to see the king's dishonor. Verse 15, that city is a rebellious city and damaging to kings and provinces. And so you see this down in verse 19, rebellion and revolt have been perpetrated in it. So they're doing everything they can to stir up an antagonistic spirit against these men. Who in the world wrote that letter? In chapter 4. The ones that didn't want to rebuild, that's true. Who were they? What do we call them?
Samaritans.
Samaritans. And of course, the Samaritans, as they're known in the New Testament, we talked about that in 2 Kings 17, when the northern kingdom was taken captive, and the people in Samaria were transported to Babylon, and that area was repopulated by Babylon with captives they'd taken from other countries, and then they intermarried and their religion intermixed, and thus the rise of what's called the Samaritans. And then there's an enmity that developed, and it's certainly reflected here and maybe heightened here, that existed for the next several hundred years between the Jews and the Samaritans. So that's their letter. But over here in chapter 5, you don't see that spirit of hostility. It's just this man as a government official trying to find out what his responsibility is. Do these men have a right to do this or not? And that's certainly in the domain of what he needs to find out as the governor of the province beyond the river. And you see in his letter then, this is a copy of the letter which Tatnai, the governor of the province beyond the river, and his colleagues, the officials who were beyond the river, sent to Darius the king. They sent a report to him in which it is written thus, to Darius the king all peace. Let it be known to the king that we've gone to the province of Judah and to the house of the great God. That's an interesting statement. I'm not sure why they'd write that way. Were they too still somehow influenced as Cyrus was? I don't know. To the house of the great God, which is being built with huge stones, and beams are being laid in the walls, and this work is going on with great care and is succeeding in their hands. Then we asked those elders and said to them thus, who issued you a decree to rebuild this temple and to finish this structure? We also asked them their names so as to inform you that we might write down the names of the men who were at their head. Is that factual? It is, isn't it? They're just stating the facts. This is what happened. And what's interesting in the rest of the letter, the rest of this letter, actually, who provided the content for the rest of the letter? Huh? That's right. And so they got it from the Jews, right? They let them speak for themselves, as it were. What a difference. He said, we asked them about it, and here's what they said. And then they went on to talk about what they were doing and talked about why they had even suffered by the hand of God and how Nebuchadnezzar, verse 12, had destroyed the temple and how Cyrus had issued a decree that they could rebuild the temple. And so that's what they said. So in the letter, and you get down to verse 17, now if it pleases the king, let a search be conducted at the king's treasure house, which is there in Babylon. If it be that a decree was issued by King Cyrus to rebuild this house of God at Jerusalem, and let the king send to us his decision concerning this letter. So our answer to question 4, what did the governor and officials letter request of King Darius? They're essentially asking that a search be made to confirm whether or not, if they could find in the king's archives, the royal archives, anything to confirm what they had been told by these men who were engaged in this work. And so they went and searched the archives, and as we'll see, that their statement was confirmed. We see again, of course, God's hand in all of this by using Cyrus, and that his decree that he had issued becomes again a critical factor. It was a critical factor when they first returned. And that decree is a critical factor again because it's written in the royal archives, preserved there, and has an impact on whether or not they can resume this work now without opposition. And so God's hand is in it, although you don't read God in every verse. God's hand is behind what's happening to accomplish his work. All right, we move into chapter 6 now. And we suggested that you review your synopsis of chapter 6. Not 4. And it's 2 sections. The first 12 verses are about what? Darius' decree. And then the last part of the chapter is about what? Temple is finished, 13 through 22. So when you got in chapter 1, it began with a decree by Cyrus that they could return and rebuild the temple. It's not until chapter 6. That is accomplished. Those 6 chapters form a unit or a section with a break after chapter 6 in time and events. Okay, we ask you after you read the first 12 verses, essentially, could you sum up Cyrus's decree? Essentially, what did he say in this decree? Can you sum it up in a few words? What? They have full support of the king. That's a good way to put it. He said, don't oppose them. Let the temple be built and provide everything they need. That's the full support of the king, like Don said. And essentially, that's what this decree was. What a heartening thing for these exiles to hear from King Darius. So, you see the reference in verse 3 to Cyrus's decree. So now verse 6. Now, therefore, Tatnai, in view of that decree, verse 7, leave this work on the house of God alone. But that's not all. Not only leave it alone, he said, verse 8, I have issued a decree concerning what you're to do for these elders of Judah in the rebuilding of the house of God. The full cost is to be paid to those people from the royal treasury out of the taxes of the provinces beyond the river, and that without delay. Verse 11, I decree that any man who violates this edict, a timber shall be drawn from his house, and he shall be impaled on it, and his house shall be made a refuse heap on account of this. Pretty serious edict, wasn't it? You let those fellows alone, you provide everything they need, and dare anyone oppose this, the consequences are going to be very severe. So, in verse 13, the second part of chapter 6, and Tatnai, the governor of the province beyond the river, and Shethar-Bozenai and their colleagues carried out the decree with all diligence, just as King Darius had sent. The elders of the Jews were successful in building through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo. They finished building according to the command of the God of Israel. No, and the decree of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. At the end of the chapter, verse 22, it says, right at the end, they observed the feast of unleavened bread 7 days with joy. And I know it says, for the Lord had caused them to rejoice and had turned the heart of the king of Assyria toward them to encourage them in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel. So we ask you a question on your sheet. Number six, how would you describe the last part of verse 22? Probably not a very clear question. Maybe the verses I provided would help somewhat. Maybe I should have included on that also verse 14. But what do you see in verse 14 in the last part of 22? Okay, that's right. God is ruling in these kingdoms of men, isn't he? In Proverbs 21:1, the king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wishes. And so, when did Solomon live, who wrote and composed the Proverbs? In the 900s. And we're reading from Ezra in the 500s. And so 400 years earlier it was stated there that God turned the king's heart wherever he wishes. And then when did Daniel prophesy? Okay, in the 600s and 500s, wasn't he taken captive and down from taking captive 605 and went on into the reign of Cyrus, so in the 500s. And so look at Daniel chapter 1 and verse 2. Now this is when Jerusalem fell at Nebuchadnezzar's attack on it. And it says in verse 1, the king of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Look at the way verse 2 is written. And it's a theme in Daniel. The Lord gave. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. Did Nebuchadnezzar realize the Lord gave him? Huh? Not at first he didn't. Not at that time he did, but he's going to learn, isn't he? And you get over to chapter 2 and verse 36 and 37. In this dream that Nebuchadnezzar has of the statue, where it describes Nebuchadnezzar as the head of gold, Daniel says in verse 37, you, O king, are the king of kings to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom. Now you would think that since Daniel could not only interpret his dream but tell him what he dreamed, you know, he wouldn't tell the wise man. He can tell him what he dreamed and tell him what it meant, that he would put some stock in what Daniel says. God made you king, Daniel. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar. But when you get to chapter 4, he's still got an important lesson to learn, doesn't he? And you remember what happened in his life. And then you get over to chapter 4 and verse 17. He says, this sentence is by the decree of the angelic watchers, and the decision is a command of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whom he wishes. Verse 25, Nebuchadnezzar needed to recognize into the verse that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. That's in the 600s, 500s B.C. When was that sermon preached in Acts 17? Approximately. We're not asking a date. Just 330 A.D.? 200 B.C.? Okay, first century is all I'm looking for. So we're talking about 500 years later. And when you look at Acts 17, when Paul's preaching in the city of Athens, not to Jews and not to Christians, but he makes another similar statement. In Acts chapter 17, verse 26, he made from one every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. That phrase is a phrase that talks about God determining where kingdoms rule and how long they rule. And Paul's still preaching that. And in chapter 24, I put that on here because Tertullus the lawyer said, since we have through you attained much peace, and since by your providence reforms are carried out for this nation. He's talking to Felix, the governor. But note he recognizes the idea of providence. Felix didn't go arrest anybody, but he did institute some actions that helped make some reforms. So that was providence of the ruler. Even that lawyer recognized that. We're reading about divine providence. He causes through his powers and his authority things to happen to accomplish his will. So in chapter 6, as a result of that, they did complete the temple. When was the temple finished? 516, 20 years later. That's right. And how long was this after it was destroyed? 70 years. 70 or 586, that's right. And how many goats were offered, verse 17? 12. You might think only Judah and Benjamin were there, but evidently there were some remnants of the other tribes that showed an interest in serving God. And that's indicated not only in this passage, but in others. The realm even of Hezekiah and Josiah, there were a remnant of those who had been taken captive who were interested in worshiping God. At the end of chapter 6, we got question number 7. What event of extreme importance happened in the time period after chapter 6 and before the time period of chapter 7? The book of Esther. Okay, good. Lord willing, on Wednesday we'll begin with chapter 7. All right? Thank you very much.